In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Monday, October 13th, 2014. We're talking today to Dan McCarthy because I had somebody ask me on my Facebook page about the subject of left and right and what it all means. And I thought, that's a good question. I bet there are people who could use some clarification on this. So I've brought on Dan McCarthy, who is editor of The American Conservative magazine. You can check them out at theamericanconservative.com. Dan McCarthy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Tom. I'm glad to be back.
I had somebody make a request on my Facebook page the other day, facebook.com/Thomas E. Woods. For those of you who want to make requests, I can't make any promises, but if you come up with a good topic for which I can think of a good guest, then chances are I'll do it. And somebody was saying, can we get to the bottom, please, once and for all, of what left and right really mean? What do these terms mean? Now, these days, Dan, especially among some libertarians, we hear a lot of people saying left and right are meaningless. It's the designation, if it ever meant anything, no longer holds. I don't agree with that. I think the terms do mean something. They did mean something. They continue to mean something. Even if people on both sides, I think, sometimes try to confuse their own followers into thinking that they have disagreements with people on the other side just because they're on the other side. So I do think there are ways that the division can be misused, but clearly left does mean something and right does mean something. If I say so-and-so is a leftist, I'm not just saying that person favors single-payer health care. That's a result of the root beliefs that person holds. So that's what I want to do today, is get to the bottom of this. If I say so-and-so is a leftist, if so-and-so describes himself as a leftist, let me put it that way, what is that person saying about himself fundamentally?
Well, he's putting himself in a certain historical context. The idea of left and right, as a lot of people know, comes out of the French Revolution, where you had the National Assembly, which is a joint assembly of all the three estates, come together and sort of abolish the old estates and then start debating how far the French Revolution was going to go. Were they going to get rid of the king? Were they going to get rid of the church? You know, how far was it going to extend? And on the left side of the chamber, you had the radicals. You said, yes, we're going to have a more egalitarian France. We're going to have a more individualistic France. And on the right, you had the people who tended to be defenders of the status quo, who believed in maintaining the class distinctions, maintaining the status of the church, and maintaining the monarchy. So even though that seems like a very governmental kind of differentiation in terms of the structure of the Constitution of France in the 18th century, which seems like a really distant and far-removed situation from our own, in fact, I think there actually is a sort of broader impact that that kind of framework has. And the impact it has is that it has to do with the nature of groups and social institutions in society. And the left has always been in favor of changing those relations, trying to even them out, trying to get rid of not only the formal legal privileges of old institutions, but even, I think, to get rid of their cultural privileges in the sense that they have some sort of unique function in society, whereas the right has always tended to defend older institutions and ways of life and the sort of habits that become insisted as institutions, and has tried to say that, no, actually, this is what it means to be part of what it means to be a human being, simply to experience life in groups and in sort of these organs of society. And it's certainly part of what it means to have a national life, to be French or to be British, to be American, or what have you. So I think that's one of the key differences between left and right, which even though it has a historical origin, it also comes out as having certain ripple effects today.
I think what follows from all this is the distinction between left and right that has to do with the left's confidence that it can take these old institutions, make them new or abolish them, as the case may be. From the point of view of a disinterested observer, rationally imposing a plan on society, Whereas on the right, there is a tremendous skepticism of the ability of any planner to do this. Because from the right's point of view, the institutions that we're talking about are natural to mankind and can't be uprooted and reassembled like a set of tinker toys. And so you have, on the one hand, the leftist planner who thinks he's going to use his unaided reason as a guide for organizing society, whereas the person on the right hears the term, hears the phrase organizing society and recoils.
I think that's largely true. And in addition to that, there's also an element of prophecy as well as planning. The left historically has always envisioned itself as the party of the future. And their idea of remaking societies, by getting rid of the old institutions, you will necessarily, just automatically, create a better world, and that the only thing standing in the way of human progress is basically the chains of the past. And the right, people who don't agree with that vision, have always been much more skeptical of that. They think that, regardless of how flawed our existing institutions may be, chances are they've come to exist for a reason. They've evolved for a reason, and they can be reformed, certainly, but if you abolish them, you're not guaranteed to get a better result, whereas the left really does think that the future is simply to be achieved by demolishing the past.
And I think the right's view also is that it's a lot easier to undermine an institution than it is to build it back up again. If it turns out that the institution you're attacking is actually a linchpin of civilized life and now you've gone and ruined it, well, it may take a long time to build it back up again. Now, if that's the left's view, if they have this view that progress is synonymous really with emancipation from the past, how could we ever get to a point that we're fully emancipated from the past? Is there a natural end point to what the left is aiming at? Or is it just perpetual revolution, that every order that the left establishes is then going to be undermined by the next generation of the left?
It actually does become perpetual revolution. In fact, you've seen this from leftists throughout the past century and more. Even Thomas Jefferson, who's someone who's, a kind of mixed character, and in many ways he does have this sort of Republican devotion and a devotion to a Whig ideal that makes him less than a complete leftist. But even Thomas Jefferson believes that every generation, the Constitution should just be ripped up and started anew completely afresh. And certainly, in the 20th century, one saw real leftists go to enormous extremes. I mean, the Cultural Revolution in China, for example, was precisely an attempt to say, we've already had a Chinese revolution. We've already put the Communist Party in power. And, but that's not enough. And now the Communist Party itself is, slightly conservative. It's slightly less radical than it was at the beginning. So we're going to destroy society once more in order to create a more radical, Chinese Revolution 2.0. And, I think the left, fundamentally, as a tendency, has no limits. It doesn't place any kind of bounds on its, desire to constantly strive for utopia by destroying the present and destroying actually existing human life.
Now, even though you're the editor of the American Conservative, you're, of course, interested in libertarianism. You're interested in more or less all branches of political thought, as I am. So I'd like to know, how do you think left and right do or do not apply to libertarianism? Somebody like Walter Block says they do not apply at all. Libertarianism is neither left nor right. And some people say, well, it borrows a little from the left, it borrows a little bit from the right. Some people say it's just left or it's just right. Do you have an opinion?
Yeah, I would say two things. Based on the discussion we've been having, you see that a lot of it comes down to your attitudes toward existing habits and institutions. And if you are a sort of cultural revolutionary, it doesn't mean necessarily that you want to use state power to destroy, the 501c3 nonprofit status of churches or something like that. But even if you are someone who just on a cultural level doesn't like some of the, more Christian cultural heritage that the country has, or the, sort of just old ways of doing things, then that might put you on the left in some regard. So that would create a left-right split among libertarians just in terms of their cultural preferences, even if, in terms of their preferences about government action or non-action, rather, all libertarians might have a degree of agreement. I think there's also a second and sort of more complex dimension to libertarianism and the left and the right, which is this. When the left-right spectrum started with the French Revolution, it really did make sense for libertarians, or people who were sort of prototype libertarians, to consider themselves as being somewhat on the left, because the whole idea was to get rid of a lot of these institutions of privilege, and they really did convey legal privilege, not just sort of cultural privilege. And, you know, certainly aristocracy has legal privileges, established churches, you know, that's not freedom of religion, that's a certain religion having advantages that others do not, and receiving tax revenue from everyone and so forth. So libertarians, you know, at the original time of the left-right distinction, would have had good reason to consider themselves being on the left. The problem is that, of course, that's not where the left, which, you know, does have this tendency towards perpetual revolution, that's not where the left stayed. The left then said, well, it's not enough just to have the end of legal privilege. We're going to have to go to, you know, changing the entire nature of society, and that's going to require actually using state power in order to transform human life. So I think, you know, that's how libertarians get confused. Yes, it's true they started out on the left, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they should see themselves as being on the left today, when the left has been redefined by much more aggressive institutions, much more aggressive mentalities that use state power to change all society.
I can imagine also a person of conservative temperament thinking that the libertarian insistence on property is a barrier against revolution. And so they think of libertarianism then as a way of thinking that actually yields you stability in the long run, because it establishes private property, establishes boundaries that you can't pass, you can't trespass on. And likewise, I think I can certainly imagine people of conservative temperament feeling like, given that the left is committed to ongoing revolution, and usually that ongoing revolution involves attacks on things that I cherish, rather than holding out the vain hope that perhaps someday I'll elect decent people who will protect me from the left, maybe the best thing to do is to try not to play this game at all, and instead try to carve out a little community where I could live out my values, and if people in San Francisco want to live out their values, that's their business. And you come to a kind of a realization that there is a finite expectation that we can have about what's possible in this world in terms of establishing the kind of society we want. And maybe we can establish it only on a small scale. I have my small-scale community. You have your small-scale community. There's something conservative about that way of thinking, and yet it has libertarian implications.
I tend to agree with that. I think federalism is something that really gets rid of the left-right spectrum in a very good and helpful way. And in fact, I mean, one of the things that's interesting about the left-right spectrum is that the people on the right, the more conservative elements, going all the way back to the French National Assembly, they tended to reject the idea of the spectrum. They said, okay, we may have our differences, but we still have, you know, one kind of culture and society, and there it has its own sort of internal structure and hierarchy and differentiation. Well, with the United States, certainly that internal structure has been a federalist structure, which has left local communities and states a large amount of freedom to kind of set their own agenda. So certainly there is a way of transcending the left-right spectrum and creating a higher kind of unity by getting away from this idea that we have to have a minute way of life dictated to everyone, that you can in fact have, diversity and unity. You can have e pluribus unum.
You know, Dan, you might be interested that I had Kirkpatrick Sale on the program last week, and he is he's sort of an odd duck in a good way, in that he clearly, if you had to classify him, he would belong among the progressives on some level, given when you look at his books, you look at his history in the 60s, and yet he insists that he hasn't changed at all in supporting secession and devolution of power, because he sees that as the way of instantiating participatory democracy that he was advocating in the 1960s. But he acknowledges that his is very much a minority position on the left. I mean, he doesn't like the left-right spectrum either, but you have to call people something. And on the left, there is so much of a desire to engage in that planning, to get that clipboard out and to force society to conform to your model. That desire doesn't seem to stop at the border of the state, at the border of an American state. They want to impose it on the whole country. So it would be nice to say we can transcend the left-right spectrum by saying, look, you Vermonters can do your thing, and then people in some other state can do their thing. But in actual practice, I find people on the left are not willing to accept that. And certainly there are some people on the right who aren't willing to accept it either. I don't think Mike Huckabee would accept that either.
Well, and as you say, someone like Kirkpatrick Sale considers himself to be on the left, and he is willing to, you know, endorse the Federalist and, you know, highly devolved kind of political system. So I don't think that left-right necessarily adheres to a sort of centralist, anti-centralist perspective.
Right.
Clearly the left does have universalistic ambitions, which tend to be stronger than the universalistic ambitions of the right. But there are a lot of left-wingers who are also... they do have a tradition of their own, I should say, of decentralism. So I do see some grounds for saying that what I want to avoid there, actually, is a confusion where everyone just automatically assumes that if someone like Kirkpatrick Sale identifies himself as being on the left, it necessarily means that he wants to centralize power, because, of course, that's not correct with Kirkpatrick Sale, and it may not be correct with some other people either. So this is one of the reasons and one of the ways in which I think the left-right spectrum can actually confuse people. So even though it does have meaning, it shouldn't be taken as signifying a lot of concrete particular policies and points of view. It's a general tendency and a general attitude towards institutions and towards ways of life. And I think people confuse themselves if they put too much content in it and just project too many specifics into what it means when someone identifies as left and right.
Well, certainly on the localism question, we can see how people who have different points of view in terms of what way of life they'd like to follow can agree to disagree. I'll do this and you'll do that and we'll leave each other alone. But there are other ways, too, that we've seen left and right, if not become friendly, then at least in some cases, as we've seen with Ralph Nader's recent book, figure out ways to work with each other on certain things. Now, given the way we've been describing left and right, that would almost seem impossible because they're engaged in such radically different projects. How can it be that there are circumstances in which the revolutionists, so to speak, and those who would conserve the past can yet somehow work together on something? Could the U.S. government be so perverse that it could bring these groups together?
It's a great question. In some cases, you know, I look at someone like Ralph Nader, and I see someone who's actually temperamentally very conservative, even though, you know, his views on the economy, for example, would not place him among, you know, certainly not among libertarians and really not among most conservatives either. But, yeah, Ralph Nader doesn't strike me as someone who is driven to sort of upend society. And the thing is, too, the way our federal government works, the way that, you know, state power in general works, is it does tend to try to reshape society in its own image in both directions. Even though the left, I think, has a natural affinity for using state power to try to remake human life and try to remake all values and institutions, the fact is, you know, the state is very happy to continue to grow if right-wing values are put into it,
yeah,
and are used to try to reshape a society also. So, you know, or you know, even crony capitalist values, right? So Ralph Nader, some of his criticisms, for example, of commercialism in the public schools have actually found support from Christian conservatives, for example, because they see that you've got a captive audience. You have public school children who are then being force-fed, basically, a commercial radio service on their school bus. And you can see why both Christian conservatives and Ralph Nader would see that there's something problematic here, that you have a combination of state power and local profit, and sort of a private profit, rather, that you know, really creates some perverse incentives. So, yeah, I mean, the amount of power and meddling that the state gets up to really does create some strange bedfellows.
All right, let's bring in the neoconservatives, right? There's no conversation with Dan McCarthy, from my point of view, is complete without mentioning the neoconservatives. Because we sometimes, well, I don't want to include you in this. I sometimes, just to get their dander up, I guess, I will sometimes insinuate that there's a strain of leftism in the neoconservative outlook. But I'm not doing that just to bother them. I'm doing it to get them to think. Because they claim to be anti-leftist. After all, they're neo-conservative, right? They're supposed to be conserving something. And yet there is running through neoconservatism, which comes in numerous varieties, to be sure, and you can find it in some people more abundantly and clearly than in others, but there is certainly a thread of leftist universalism in neoconservatism. Do you see that? And if so, where is it and what is it?
Well, it certainly exists in foreign policy, where the neocons pretty much explicitly are in favor of worldwide global democratic revolution. And what that actually means is destroying existing political regimes, destroying existing states. And what we see happening, as you know, has been the case in Iraq, is that when you do that, you actually unleash chaos. And you unleash, you know, just rampant violence and civil war. So, but that's, you know, revolutionaries see that as being basically no bad thing, right? You've got to break a lot of eggs in order to make an omelet. So, you know, I think the neocons are not terribly embarrassed by what their own war, you know, which first of all deposed Saddam Hussein and then led to this sort of ongoing slow motion and now, you know, fast-forwarded civil war in Iraq and of course, also Syria now. I think the neocons are unembarrassed by that. I think they see this as part of what they were trying to do. Obviously, they would have been happier if things had gone, you know, directly from revolution to a sort of American-style liberal democracy. But I think they still think it's worth it to have this, you know, absolute bloodshed in order to get some sort of imaginary utopian future at the end. And that's a purely, you know, far-left revolutionary perspective. You know, Bret Stephens, one of these neocons who's very prominent on the panel, he had an interview just earlier this week, I think with the University of Chicago Alumni Magazine, saying that, oh, yeah, he was totally, you know, comfortable with his decision to support the Iraq war. There are a few neocons. I mean, strangely enough, David Frum, of all people, has actually expressed some doubts about the Iraq war in retrospect. There are a few neocons who really do seem a little bit troubled by what their policies have achieved. But for the most part, they are totally in favor of destroying bad but, you know, livable existing circumstances in order to create what they hope will be utopian circumstances, but actually turn out to be even worse than unlivable circumstances in the present.
In other words, where's my omelet? You broke all the eggs. Where's the omelet? We never seem to get the omelet. It's funny, by the way, that you mentioned David Frum, because I very often cite his book, An End to Evil, as exactly what it is I'm talking about with the neoconservatives. That, could you imagine Russell Kirk writing a book called An End to Evil? I mean, he would think this must be some leftist tract or something. Like, an end to evil? What are you talking about? An end to evil on this earth, in this life, with these human beings? You're telling me you're going to bring about an end to evil. Now, granted, you give people a little poetic license when it comes to a book title, but I'm pretty sure Russell Kirk would have died a thousand deaths before agreeing to a title like that. But then also, even on the domestic front, if I read somebody like David Brooks or any of these neocons who posture as conservatives in the mainstream, because the neocons are as far as the mainstream will generally go in admitting the existence of conservatives, they will say things like, in a presidential cycle, they'll say, we need somebody who's ready to govern. And that phrase, I don't know about you, Dan, but I find that incredibly creepy. Ready to govern. What does that mean? Ready to what? To boss people around? To tell people what to do? To change and affect people's lives in all kinds of undesirable ways? What does that mean, ready to govern? They have a policy wonkish approach to the domestic sphere. And my own view, which I will concede to you may be an extreme one, is that the very idea of public policy is borderline leftist in and of itself, because it again amounts to the substitution for what people would prefer to see happen of a plan managed by School of Government PhDs.
Well, let me go back to your point about evil, an end to evil, because I think that actually gets at something fundamental that scholars like Klaus Rinn, for example, have discussed. And that is that the left tends to have this view of evil as being something external. It's, you know, either in our institutions,
right,
or it's in other countries.
Right.
And therefore it's something that can be destroyed. You know, you just abolish, you know, religion, or you go and you invade another country and destroy its government. And that is creating an end to evil. Whereas the more classical view, which you find both in sort of Greek and Roman literature and also in the Christian tradition and basically almost all religious traditions, is the view that evil is something that you can never get rid of because it's partly intrinsic. And you not only have to fight evil that's outside of yourself, but you also have to fight, you know, the tendency towards hubris and the tendency towards pride and the tendency towards self-aggrandizement and grasping for power that is intrinsic within all human beings, you know, to one degree or another. So I think that's a fundamental difference in a view of human nature between the left and the right. And the left really does have this sense that evil is something that, because it exists somewhere else on, in the world, can simply be destroyed by, you know, heavy weaponry. As far as public policy goes, I don't know that I agree with you there, because even in the most traditional kind of political order, you all obviously do have public institutions, you do have institutions of government of one kind or another, which have pursued policies, and those policies, I don't see that the word public policy itself necessarily indicates policies or policies that overreach their proper sphere. But certainly, I mean, when the left talks about public policy and when neocons do, they do have a tendency to want someone who kind of has a grand plan and makes everyone, you know, feel like part of a an army on the march, so to speak. And that's, you know, something that conservatives and libertarians alike have to look at with a great deal of skepticism.
Your point about evil being external reminds me of the various utopians that you can find in American society from about the 1820s to the 1850s, and they did exactly that. Their view, some of them would say, the one thing holding us back from the great society, so to speak, is private property. In some cases, they viewed it to be private property. You had utopian communities set up to live without private property, and none of them lasted longer than 2 years. Or it was alcohol. Alcohol is the source of our problems. It leads to family breakup and crime and poverty and so on. And I'm not defending alcoholism, obviously, but again, this is the key thing. We get rid of this, we solve our problems. Or then it became ignorance. Ignorance is our problem. One of the great in the just the historical sense, educational reformers of the 19th century said that we would get rid of 90% of crime if we could have universal compulsory education. Or the family. There were the folks up in the Oneida settlement. And under John Humphrey Noyes, and their view was that the family was a problem because monogamous marriage led to all kinds of rivalrousness. You know, my wife's prettier than your wife, and you can't have access to her, only I can. And so they would, one after another, they would try and topple one of these institutions, thinking that that was the locus of evil. And so you're exactly right. Again, if you compare that to Kirk or Edmund Burke or any of these classical conservatives, they would think this is nutball. That's not where evil is ultimately to be found. All right. I'm going to leave you
go ahead. Point. Well, I just want to jump in, actually, with 2 points you brought up, because I think they're very important and they tend to get overlooked. Prohibition, as you know, and the whole idea of, you know, sort of a hardcore temperance movement, not just a kind of social movement to get people to, you know, drink less, but an attempt to actually, you know, really restrict alcohol sales. This was always seen as being a progressive and a left-wing effort, even though it was, you know, often promulgated by people who, you know, in their personal lives were very Christian and very conservative in some respects, precisely because it had that sort of externalization of evil and this sort of utopian goal, this idea that if only we got rid of this external problem, it would lead to a suddenly virtuous life, when in fact, you know, a virtuous life is a matter of sort of internal struggle and battling your own, you know, sort of a tendency towards sin. It's not about simply blaming a substance for all of your problems. And obviously a substance can contribute to other, you know, flaws that you have, but it's obviously not the cause of evil in the world. So you're exactly right. And not only is that true of prohibitionism in the past, but it's also true of the drug war today. And I think that so much of, in fact, I mean, you can just look at the rhetoric of people who consider themselves conservative Republicans when they talk about their support for the drug war. And it looks very utopian. It looks very much leftist in its idea that evil is a purely external force. But the other thing we should probably talk about just for a few minutes here, though, is property, because you did point out quite correctly that property is something that, because it has a certain, you know, element of stability to it, it can be a great bulwark against revolution, great bulwark against, you know, bad changes. But it also, I think one thing that traditionalist conservatives and libertarians disagree with here is libertarians tend to place an increasing emphasis on property over time, I think. Whereas traditionalist conservatives say everything doesn't reduce to property and everything doesn't reduce to individual rights. And that, in fact, there is a somewhat left-wing, faintly left-wing element in trying to change society so that those elements are stronger than other elements. So, for example, with something like divorce, conservatives tended to be very critical of the idea of no-fault divorce and saying this is just an individual contract, you can negate it at any time. Whereas I think libertarians have a tendency to say, well, you know, on a purely individualist basis, you know, freely contracting individuals should not be bound by any other sort of social pressures or legal restrictions.
That is a key point. That is another key area of differentiation. But that opens up so many other topics. The issue of the family is very interesting because I think in part, I think by and large, libertarians have done a really lousy job of theorizing about the family. I think the family, which is, you know, not a small thing, has actually been a huge stumbling block for a lot of libertarians because they are insisting on taking their view of government and the reasons they're unhappy with government and trying to force that into why they're unhappy with the family as it's traditionally understood or as it exists in law. And I'm not so sure – that's certainly not a view that I take. I mean, for example, Walter Block has had a really, really interesting back and forth about parents and children with a much lesser known but very significant figure, Jakub Wisniewski. And Wisniewski is as Rothbardian as can be, but he still is able to come out with arguments in favor of positive obligations that parents have. It's not merely negative obligations. Don't kill your kid with an axe. He's able to show that that you can derive positive obligations. So there's much more that needs to be done, certainly in that area. But before I let you go, Dan, I know you've done this in the past, but you know, if people are like me, they have short memories. Give people a quick pitch for what the American Conservative is all about. The website is theamericanconservative.com.
Well, the American Conservative, it's a magazine of realist conservatism, reality-based conservatism, which was much mocked by the Bush administration, 10 years ago. But we stand for a conservatism that, you know, sees America as having limits to its foreign policy and sort of limits to these utopian ambitions that we've been discussing in this podcast. So the website is theamericanconservative.com. The magazine is produced, on a bi-monthly basis, and it has, you know, some of the most brilliant writers you can imagine. Not only is Tom Woods one of our contributing editors, but a number of guests on your show, such as Bill Kaufman, are regular, put in regular appearances in our pages. So I highly recommend our magazine to everyone who enjoys the Tom Woods podcast.
Well, thanks again, Dan. I appreciate your time. Interesting conversation. More interesting, even, I bet, if we had a few drinks. Maybe we should experiment with that next time I have you on. All right.
Quite so. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, Dan. All right, everybody, a few announcements. Of course, the key one is that my new book is sort of coming out tomorrow. Now, what do I mean, sort of? Well, I'm not going to do the full court press on it until all three formats are available. And I haven't done self-publishing before. I've always had regular publishers. So the audiobook is taking a few extra days to get finished. And I really do want all three out there when I do my official launch. But you guys are the cream of the crop. I mean, you're the people who listen to me regularly, who like what I'm doing, who support what I'm doing. So I'll tell you guys that it's out. As of tomorrow, the 14th of October, 2014, it will be available in Kindle and paperback formats, and shortly thereafter in audiobook. Obviously, you can stay tuned to this program. I'll give you details about that. The book is called Real Dissent: A Libertarian Sets Fire to the Index Card of Allowable Opinion. I think you are going to enjoy this book. I am very, very pleased with it. Now, remember, of course, those of you who support the show as supporting listeners will, of course, get the Kindle edition as part of your benefits. But the way that works is not that it gets emailed to you automatically. You have to go to supportinglisteners.com, sign in, and indicate that you want it. Send me your email address. You'll see a way to do that. Because when you go through Kindle Direct Publishing, the only way I can distribute the book to you is by gifting it to you through Amazon. And so I need your email address to do that. And of course, I'm sure there are some people who support me, who support the show, who won't have time ever to get to the book. So I'd rather, since I have to gift it to you, just wait and see who really wants to read it. Then you go ahead and indicate in your account at supportinglisteners.com. You'll see how easy it is that, yep, I want it. And then that means that on the release date, if you've already requested it, you will get an email saying so-and-so, well, not so-and-so, me, has gifted you this book, and that's how it'll work. And then, of course, anybody who joins the Supporting Listener program after that, you'll get it within 24 hours of asking for it at supportinglisteners.com. It's one way of thanking you guys for helping make the show possible. Also, I am having my site redesigned at tomwoods.com so that the show's headquarters will be tomwoods.com. I'll still have tomwoodsradio.com that I'll use as a redirect to get you to tomwoods.com, but I really want to fold these things together, and I want it to be a lot more user-friendly. I don't think the interface we have at tomwoodsradio.com is user-friendly at all, and we don't have a show notes page, per se, for each episode. It's not the way it should be. So it's going to be the way it should be. I've had the design done, and so now it's just a matter of getting the coding done. So in a few weeks, we should be launching the new site, and it'll be a lot easier to use, and search functionality, and looking for old episodes will be easy, and I'll have more robust show notes for each show after that. So be patient with that. It is coming. The new and improved TomWoods.com is indeed coming. All right. Thanks so much, everybody, for listening. Thanks for supporting the show. Thanks for subscribing to the show for free, of course, on iTunes or Stitcher over at TomWoodsRadio.com. And we'll see you with another episode tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
The Tom Woods Show.